At the end. Okay, I brought in the midterms again, so I'll be distributing them the same way at the end of the class. If you weren't in class on Friday and like to pick up your midterm, see me at the end of the class. And this is for the people who aren't here today or just listening on Bruincast. If you haven't picked up your midterm yet and you'd like to pick it up, you should come to my office hours, Tuesday, 3 to 5. That's the time to pick it up. I'm not going to bring in the midterms to class again on Wednesday or anything. Okay. This lecture today is the second of a two-part lecture on the 1949 to 1954 period, an extremely important period in the history of the Cold War. Why? Because this whole story of 1949 to 54 culminates in the signing and ultimately ratification of what we call the Paris Accords. The Paris Accords of October 1954, right? The Paris Accords, which established the basic framework for relations among the Western powers. That's to say, United States and the three big European allies, Britain, France, and West Germany, for the remainder of the Cold War period. Right? Why were the Paris Accords so important? Not just because they established the framework for relations within the Western Bloc, but also they establish a certain framework. Yes?
Can you enlarge the text?
Well, yeah, if I enlarge it, then you're going to miss the stuff at the bottom. Do you want? I'll do it that way if you like. All right. Okay. Maybe when I get further into the lecture, I'll take the screen down a bit. All right. By the way, it's also available online. It's posted in the outlines section of the website. All right. Paris Accords important not just because they established the framework for relations within the Western Bloc, but also a possible framework for a decent political relationship between East and West. That's why I titled the lecture A Chance for Peace. This is the third great chance for peace in the post-war period. And the way we're structuring the analysis of the Cold War is there were four times in which you could say there was a chance for peace. The first three times, 1945, 49, 54, all failed. They were all followed by crises, a deterioration of relations. The fourth time, under Kennedy, 1963, succeeded. Right? Three false dawns and then one true dawn. You know, that provides us a framework for understanding these things, because every time we look at a particular episode, we say, well, this carries within it the seeds of a possible East-West accommodation, a stable international order. Then what happens? Why does it fail? Until we come to 1963 and the post-63 period. All right? So that's our framework. And this, in a sense, this 49 to 54 period is kind of the most interesting. And we were developing the analysis by simply reconstructing the story of What happened after 1949? Why did the sort of system that you might have thought had come to being by the spring of 1949, a formal division of Europe into two blocks, the formal establishment of the two German states, the establishment of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, the end of the Berlin blockade, which symbolized Soviet acceptance of what the Western powers were doing in West Germany. Why did this not lead to a stable peace? In fact, very soon, relations between East and West had deteriorated, and you have the very real risk of a new world war, third world war, in the winter of 1950-51. What happened? And the answer there was the 1949 arrangements didn't establish the basis for a stable international order because the Soviets had not accepted, deep down in any serious way, what the Western powers were doing with West Germany. The Western strategy and the creation of the Federal Republic was another step along the Western strategy, was something the Soviets were bound to find threatening. Not because we wanted to threaten them, but because the measures we took for purely defensive purposes were bound to pose a challenge to the Soviets that they would find hard to live with. Because who could tell how far this thing was going to go? Today you're establishing a West German state, Not a fully independent state by any means. It was still under military occupation. There was something called the Occupation Statute that governed relations between the Federal Republic and the three Western occupying powers, right? But who could tell what the future would hold? Eventually, wouldn't that West German state have to be given more in the way of political rights, more in the way of sovereignty and so on? And the real test of whether a country is truly independent, whether it's able to stand on its own two feet, is can it develop the means with which to protect itself, to defend itself? Can it build an army, an air force, and so on? And if the Germans went down that route, given their profound dissatisfaction with the status quo, the division of their country, the fact that half of pre-war German territory was under effective Soviet control, wouldn't the eventual establishment of a strong Germany be viewed by the Soviets as deeply threatening? So who could tell how far the Germans would go once they became strong? You see, you didn't have to, if you were looking at this stuff from the Soviet point of view, you didn't have to worry about the Americans and the British and the French. Their true attitudes had been revealed by their behavior in the post-war period. They were quite happy to live with a divided Germany, to accept the status quo of the divided Europe. But you couldn't say the same thing about the West Germans, right? So the Soviets did not, in 1949, accept what the Western powers had done in West Germany and were continuing to do. They had to accept it for the time being for purely military reasons, because in military terms, they weren't in a position to challenge it, right? If a war broke out, yes, they would be able to overrun all of Western Europe in the initial phase of the war. But then the Americans would gear up and start building more atomic bombs and more bombers. The war might last 5 or 10 years. But as long as America had a nuclear monopoly, the outcome of the war could not be in question. Okay. Right. So that was why the Berlin business was put on ice, why it seemed that the Soviets were accepting things. They had to accept it because in military terms they were in a position to challenge it. Right. Defense of Europe, however, rested on a very narrow basis, the American nuclear monopoly. It was for that reason that the United States could afford to rely on a tripwire strategy for the defense of Western Europe. You didn't have to build up a large military force and being, because everyone knew that in the long run, when the United States would win the war, you could count on the prospect of a long air atomic war to deter the Soviets, to prevent them from marching to the Atlantic. Right? Overnight, that whole situation changed. Overnight. That's why I put that date, August 29th, 1949, on the blackboard last time, because that date is a fundamental importance to the story. That's the date the Soviets exploded their first nuclear device, detected immediately by the Americans, right? The American nuclear monopoly is broken. The one thing that had counterbalanced Soviet land superiority in Europe, American nuclear monopoly, no longer exists. There's no longer a counterweight to Soviet power in Europe, right? And the sense was that, if a new war broke out, the United States might well lose. This is what General Bradley said in late 1950. We might well lose. Because all of these problems that really didn't matter much in the era of the American nuclear monopoly, the vulnerability of our overseas bases, the small size of the nuclear stockpile, the absence of adequate target intelligence, and all those kinds of things, now they mattered a great deal. Because there would be a race, and those sorts of things would determine which side would win the race. Right? As each side sought to destroy the air atomic infrastructure of its opponent. The bomb factories, the bomb stockpiles, the air bases, the aircraft assembly plants, and so on. And if you could develop superiority in terms of air atomic power, you could then go on to destroy your enemy as a functioning society. Might last a long time because these early atomic bombs are weapons of relatively limited power. But eventually, whichever side was able to get the upper hand in such a war would be able to win. Right? So that's why we were so scared in 1950. It was assumed that the balance had shifted practically overnight and that the Soviets, who had been cautious in the late 1940s, were going to pursue a more aggressive policy. We didn't know where it would come. In the event it came in Korea, when Stalin decided, after holding back for quite some time, to give the green light to the North Koreans to attack the South. Not only that, but to encourage the Chinese to enter the war against America, which is a much more serious thing. Because when he encouraged the North Koreans to attack, there was on the assumption that the Americans wouldn't intervene. We had put South Korea outside our defense perimeter. We'd made it clear. We'd withdrawn our troops from South Korea and so on. So it's like, you can say, well, what's there to lose? The Americans have written off South Korea. When the Americans intervened and the Chinese were encouraged to attack the Americans, well, this was much more serious. Right? This was in the, October, November of 1950, the Chinese came in. Right? And the Chinese not only pushed the United States out of North Korea, but so far to the south that they were threatening to just, push the Americans off the entire Korean Peninsula. This was like to inflict a huge humiliation on the United States. The Soviets seemed to be playing with fire. What's going on here? Right? It's their sense, Soviet sense, by this point, that war with America might be inevitable. And the Soviets had a certain window of opportunity. I quoted that famous comment that Stalin made to Mao from late 1950. He said, if war is inevitable, let it happen now. The Americans were very, very, they understood this whole logic, why the Soviets would feel that maybe now is the best time for a showdown with the United States. Okay. And we had all this... actual other evidence that supported this notion that the Soviets were in a warlike a mood, that they were contemplating a third world war. For example, they were getting the East European satellite regimes to be prepared for a war. We knew this because our intelligence services had penetrated the East European regimes much more thoroughly than they had ever been able to penetrate the USSR. So we knew what the Soviets were telling the East Europeans, which was get ready for war. And we also knew what the Soviets were doing in terms of material preparations for war, the kind of stockpiles that they were building up, which implied that they viewed that a war might well be imminent. Okay. What do we do? Do we simply say, we don't want to provoke these people, let's pull in our horns politically? Well, to a certain extent. I mean, this one of the reasons the United States did not escalate the Korean War in those early years was a sense that the Soviets were poised on the brink, and if we push too hard, this might push them over the brink and lead them to precipitate a Third World War. But in other regards, the American attitude was anything but accommodating. The key decision was the decision to embark on an extraordinary buildup of American nuclear power, American military power in general. Decided on at the very end of 1950, in the aftermath of the Chinese intervention in the war, and the Chinese were inflicting these massive defeats on the American forces in Korea, some of the worst defeats in American military history. You know, this is traumatic for the U.S. government at this point. This NSC 68/4 of December 1950, vast increase in American military power, you know, quadrupling, by some measures, a quintupling of military spending, the importance of which is magnified by the fact that we're in the midst of a revolution in military technology, especially in the nuclear area, but in all kinds of other areas as well, not least of which had to do with intelligence gathering technology. Okay, and ultimately the balance shifts. You recall that graph I put on the blackboard last time, right? There's a fragile balance in the late 1940s. Neither side wants a war at that point. American position deteriorates quite dramatically following the breaking of the American nuclear monopoly. Right? The sense of if a war breaks out, 1950 or so, we might well lose. We get involved in this buildup. The buildup is slow precisely because the technological revolution is running its course. It takes a long time to gear up the factories and so on, design the weapons that embody this new technology. But when it comes, it has a massive, dramatic impact, because what it means is America has all this technologically advanced equipment. The Soviets have a huge amount of equipment, but basically it's all obsolete as a result of what the Americans now have. So by the end of the Truman period, prior to Eisenhower coming to power in January of 1953, we're talking late 1952, the decisions that had been made, the rearmament decisions of NSC 68/4, have now paid off in terms of the utter transformation of the military balance. The United States is so strong at this point. So strong, not just in the sort of atomic capability that could have been built in around 1950, but now thermonuclear capability. The thermonuclear revolution, 1952, these massive thermonuclear explosives that are 1,000 times as powerful as the bombs that were dropped on Japan at the end of the war. The Americans are just, producing these things in massive quantities. And Soviets have nothing like it. They don't have anything like it in terms of the delivery systems. And there's a dramatic change in Soviet policy in this period as well, as America develops this upper hand. The Soviets, were quite bellicose in terms of their rhetoric and their behavior around 1950-51. By the end of 52, this is to say, before the death of Stalin and before Truman left office, right? The Soviets, I say, they're purring like pussycats, falling over themselves to be accommodating, peace-loving, and so on. Okay, so this shift in the military balance is of fundamental importance. Why? Because it means that the United States now has a free hand the Western powers and more generally, have a free hand to move ahead in creating their own political system, a structure within which their relations with each other would be regulated. And this is the system, ultimately, of the Paris Accords of October of 1954. Right? Now, they didn't have a free hand in 1950. Why was this? Because if they moved ahead in, too fast in terms of restoring sovereignty, restoring power to West Germany, that might very well tip the balance for the Soviets and provoke a Soviet military intervention. This was expected as a consequence of a Western decision to rearm Germany. The extraordinary thing is that despite all of this, the American government, in a very heavy-handed way, was pushing the European allies to sanction a rearmament of Germany as part of the policy of building up the overall power of the West. And the key figure here was the American Secretary of State, Dean Acheson, again, the real maker of American policy during the Truman administration, were his secretaries of state, not the president himself. And Acheson was a very aggressive statesman. He wanted to just, you know, push ahead quite overtly with the rearmament of West Germany as part of the general strategy of building up the power of the West as a whole. The Europeans said, it's different if Germany becomes strong than if America becomes strong in terms of the Soviet reaction. We're touching on a very raw Soviet nerve. We shouldn't do this right now. First, let's build up the overall power of the West as a whole. And only then, we're in a position to deal with any potential repercussions, can we move ahead with rearming Germany. All right? But Acheson took a very tough line with the European allies. At the New York conference in September 1950, he basically said, you want us to send our American troops over to Europe? If you want us to do that, you better agree to German rearmament. Right? See, the security of the Europeans is not a fundamental concern for Acheson. He's thinking it's essentially in terms of the U.S.-Soviet relationship, and he takes a very aggressive view. I'll just read you something. This is, if I can find it. Oh, yeah, there it is. Acheson had a very close collaborator in this period named Paul Nitze, who eventually became quite well known in his own right. This is what Paul Nitze said. He said around this time, he says, The primary goal was the preservation of the United States and the continuation of a salutary world environment. The avoidance of war was of secondary importance. Even if war were to destroy the world as we know it today, still the U.S. must win that war decisively. And then he goes on to, again, stress the point that the preservation of the U.S. was the overriding goal, not the fate of our allies. So the U.S. government, at a time of its weakness, this is September 1950, is intent on pressing ahead with what it knows to be a very provocative policy vis-a-vis the Soviets, this policy of rearming West Germany. Okay. But they're blocked. They're unable to succeed in this goal. Why are they unable to succeed? Not just because Britain and France have reservations about provoking the Soviets to that extent at a time of Western weakness. The really crucial opposition comes from the Germans themselves. The new West German state, headed by their founding chancellor, Konrad Adenauer. Right? They make the decision to say, oh, no, no. Now's not the time for reunification. They don't do it directly because of these threats that Acheson had made. Instead, they say, oh, we can't rearm right now because we still don't have our full sovereignty back. You can't expect us to rearm unless we're a sovereign nation and so on. In other words, they're melding together the military issues with the political issues. All of these issues, how much sovereignty should Germany get? What sort of army should it have? How should that army be tied in to the Western defense system as a whole? All those issues. Extremely complicated. It takes a long time to work these things out. Okay? And the French have their own way of blocking this. What the French do is, again, they don't want to kind of give Acheson a flat no, because they very much want those American troops. You know, the Soviets are quite threatening now. And the one thing that could possibly keep the Soviets at bay is a sense on their part that an attack on Europe would lead to a Third World War in which they might well be defeated in the end. No one quite knows what the outcome of such a war would be. So they want the American troops in Europe, but they don't want to pay Acheson's price, which is full speed ahead with German rearmament right now. Okay, so they come up with a plan. It's called the Pleven Plan for a European army. All the continental West Europeans, the Germans, the French, the Dutch, the Belgians, the Italians, they'd get together and they would form a single army, a single uniform, a single chain of command, and so on. Okay. Not that the French wanted this or even took this whole plan all that seriously, but it was a way of kicking up a lot of dust and giving Acheson the chance to pursue negotiations on this complicated plan, the Pleven Plan, a plan for what was to be called the European Defense Community, while a significant American combat force was being deployed to the European continent. Right? This whole period in U.S.-European relations was actually quite important, because it shaped the view that the Europeans came to hold of the United States, which was, we need these people, America's very strong, we need an American force in Europe to serve as a counterweight to the Soviets, but we can't just give them a blank check. There has to be a counterweight to American power within the Atlantic Alliance, because the Americans pursue a policy that is not congruent with our own interests. American policy was too bellicose, too belligerent. Right? It has an important effect on how especially the two main continental partners of the United States, West Germany and France, came to think about each other and came to think about building Europe, as it was called. The policy of building Europe, as we saw, was implicit in the Western strategy for Germany. French went along with this. In the words of a very good French historian, the whole policy of building Europe, of creating these supranational European structures, economically, then politically, militarily, this was to be held up to the Germans. It was a means of seducing and controlling Germany. Because these European structures in which Germany would be integrated would limit Germany's freedom of action. And the whole idea of creating a new Europe, creating a new European identity that would supersede these old-fashioned national identities, well, this would capture the imagination of Germany and serve as an outlet for Germany's political energies, and allow the Germans to kind of find a substitute for reunification as the focus of their national policy, right? But that was the initial idea of the policy of building Europe as far as the French were concerned. Now they are taking this more seriously, because they come to see that they and the West Germans are in the same boat in strategic terms, right? They're both threatened by the Soviets, and they're also both threatened by an overly aggressive American policy that could provoke a Soviet action against Western Europe. So there has to be some counterweight to American military power within the Western alliance. And that counterweight would have to be based in Europe. And because the British hold themselves aloof from too great an involvement in Western Europe, The new European counterweight would have to be built essentially in close collaboration with the two main continental West European powers, namely West Germany and France. So the French are now thinking much more seriously about the need to kind of work with the Germans, not just to provide a counterweight to Russia, but to provide a counterweight to America, right? An important point. Okay. So this whole notion of you want to build Europe half serious, half for manipulative purposes, this is yet another factor that's folded into these negotiations about the European defense community, that's to say European army, the transformation of Germany's status, because Germany's still an occupied country under the occupation statute from 1949 to 1955. You're going to have to transform Germany's political status because a strong Europe would have to be based on equality between France and Germany, not with Germany being kept down and France kind of in the driver's seat. The Germans would never go along with that. So you have in this period beginning in December of 1950 and going through the fall of 1954, a very long, very laborious, very complicated series of negotiations on this whole complex of issues, the political issues, the military issues, even some economic issues, right? And it serves its purpose. The fact that these issues are complicated and the Europeans insist that they all be treated together means that there is no German rearmament during this period of Western military weakness. The first German soldier puts on a uniform in 1955, right? Not 1950, as Acheson wanted. So German rearmament takes place in an entirely different strategic environment. After the America's rearmament had run its course, and after America had developed such an extraordinary degree of military power, very little risk to rearming Germany now. Okay. So the Western powers, after that crisis fades, and essentially beginning in 1952, sense that they have pretty much a free hand now to move ahead and create whatever system they want. What sort of system should it be? Okay? This is the fundamental choice. An Atlantic system or essentially a European system. Another, by Atlantic system, I mean basically the security of the West, the defense of Western Europe rests ultimately on American military power. America is committed to the defense of Europe, the sort of system that eventually came into being in the Cold War period, or a system where, yeah, America's in Europe for the time being to provide a kind of umbrella that keeps the Soviets at bay while the Europeans are coming together, building up their own military power so that Europe, meaning continental Western Europe, you know, basically France and Germany plus the Benelux countries in Italy, continental Western Europe can become strong enough to defend itself against the Soviets without having to rely on the Americans. Okay, and this was something that was taken quite seriously, especially by the Americans in the late 1940s. It continued to be the Truman policy through the summer of 1951, when finally Acheson was convinced that it just wasn't viable politically. The Europeans would never move ahead if they sensed that the Americans were going to pull out. The one thing that could enable the French to move ahead in terms of transforming their relationship with Germany is if they had the sense that the risks of pursuing that policy, you know, were limited because German power would be contained within a structure dominated by the United States. That if the Americans would withdraw, the French wouldn't want to take the risk of allowing Germany to become too strong. And if the Americans did pull out, the Germans would have an enormous incentive to move ahead in terms of developing their nuclear power, military power, and that meant nuclear power, right? So Acheson put the whole thing on the dream of a freestanding, independent European entity, continental West European entity, on the back burner. You know, not a matter for practical politics. Okay. The British didn't want anything to do with becoming part of some sort of European superstate. They had this quaint notion that their national sovereignty was a matter of some importance. And the Germans and the French, Germans took it much more seriously because they knew that there were all these objections to Germany recovering her power in a purely national framework. So for Germany to be defended, you know, she had much better chance of doing so if some sort of European framework came into being. And given that the Germans, you know, they didn't trust the Americans. You look at someone like Adenauer, he's like 80 years old at this time. Very, you know, or late 70s, I think. You know, this is a guy who would come of age politically under Bismarck, when Bismarck was still in power. And, you know, the whole notion of a permanent American involvement in European affairs, you know, it just seemed, well, you know, just very unlikely. And so the notion was, you got to worry about making sure that there was an effective counterweight to Soviet power in Europe. You know, given that a purely German national force was not viable for all sorts of reasons, maybe a kind of a larger European force, you know, creating a new European entity of some sort, that was the way to go. The European concept had a lot of appeal in Germany, right? But not all the way to a superstate. You know, Adenauer said, I'm a good European, but I'm not a super European. I don't believe in the end of the national state entirely. And the French are kind of in the middle here. You know, they understand that there's a need for a counterweight to American power within the alliance, but they don't want to move so heavily in the direction of a freestanding Europe that they'd be left alone on the continent of Europe with just Germany and Russia. They want the Americans to stay in. Okay? All right. So the negotiations proceed, given that all these countries are pursuing that policy. And the French turn against the EDC, even though they were the ones who had proposed this notion to begin with. They can't, no French government can get the treaty through the chamber because these limits on Germany would apply to France as well. If Germany couldn't have her own army, then France couldn't have her own army either, because you needed equality. The whole point of the EDC is to prevent the Germans from having a national army, but that implies that France couldn't have a national army. So there's no way we want to do this. And the whole policy had a certain manipulative function all along, just basically to kind of, you know, keep the Americans from following through with their threats to withdraw from Europe. Finally, the EDC goes down to defeat in August of 1954 at the hands of the French chamber. Right. What happens then? Very soon, a whole new system is put into place in October, right? From August to October. Very, very rapid progress, given how slow progress had been up to that point. This is the system established by the Paris Accords. This system established by the Paris Accords was a system based, not as the EDC was, on the notion of a freestanding continental Western Europe. It was based on the continuation of NATO, the strengthening of NATO, which meant a system based on a continuing large-scale American military presence in Europe, on a political system commensurate with that, namely a political system that rested on American power, and in which the United States would necessarily play the leading role. Right? The NATO system established by the Paris Accords. Who's responsible for this? Well, system where the United States was playing the leading role, you'd think that it was the Americans who were kind of pushing for this sort of thing, right? This NATO was the instrument of the American domination of Europe. This is what people say a lot in Europe during the Cold War period. You know, America was this great imperial power. America wanted to assert control. NATO was a vehicle for the assertion of American control over Western Europe. And the interesting thing is here that that's not why the NATO system came into being. Right? It was the Americans who opposed it. As I said, the Truman administration had supported the notion of a freestanding Europe until July of 1951, and then it abandoned it as unrealistic. But the Democrats had defeated in the November 1952 elections, and in January of 53, Eisenhower comes to power as the U.S. president. Eisenhower, you know who he was. He was like commander of the Western forces during World War II in the European theater. He was Army Chief of Staff in the late 40s, and then after a spell as president of Columbia University, he was called back and became the first NATO commander in 1951. There's a NATO commander, it's called SACUR. I guess it's time to kind of move this thing down, okay? Okay, there it is, SACUR, Supreme Allied Commander in Europe. And Eisenhower had a certain strategic concept. He wanted the Europeans to stand on their own. Right? Sure, the Americans had to be there for the time being because they needed an umbrella, an American umbrella under which they could kind of come together and rearm. And Eisenhower, his heart was set on the EDC, even though he considered it preposterous in military terms. It was just so important in political terms because it symbolized the Europeans merging themselves into a single strategic unit. We didn't want to be present in Europe forever. We didn't want to create an American empire there. Right? It was the Europeans that pressed for the NATO solution. It's like, especially the French. The French Prime Minister at this time is Pierre Mendès France, one of the most interesting figures in the whole history of this period. He allowed the EDC to go down to defeat because he saw that it was just hopeless. And he was instrumental in crafting the set of arrangements that came into being in October of 54, the arrangements embodied in the Paris Accords. So let me talk about what the Paris Accords provided for. Okay. British, the French, not the Americans, wanted this system. The Paris Accords provided for the recreation of a German army, but an army with limited armament, and in particular wouldn't be allowed to have nuclear weapons. Not only that, but the German army would be fully integrated in the NATO system, meaning that where it would be deployed, how it would be provisioned, all the kind of the whole logistical tail that would supply the forces in the field, this would be developed not on a purely national basis, but would be developed by the NATO authorities on an international basis, so that these German forces would be dependent on a logistical system that ran through their rear, namely through France. And this meant that the German army was incapable of independent military action. Right? So the risks of that a strong German army would pose were quite limited for military reasons alone. The powers of the NATO commander, SACUR, were actually expanded in the Paris Accord. NATO commander, always an American general. And basically the Europeans were intent, much more intent than the Americans were, in keeping the Americans in. The Americans didn't want it. They felt like the Europeans should be able to defend themselves. And Eisenhower and his Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, they accepted this new set of arrangements very grudgingly. They were, as I said, they had their hearts set on the EDC. Okay. Paris Accords. There were also political aspects to the Paris Accords that are very much worth noting. Germany had been, even after the creation of the Federal Republic, an occupied country. There was an occupation statute. The occupation ended with the Paris Accords, but that did not mean that Germany became fully sovereign, because there were, and this is the essence of the Paris Accord system, there were these important constraints on German freedom of action. Okay, it's called the reserved rights, sometimes called the reserved powers. Germany was semi-sovereign. What are these reserved rights? The forces of the three Western powers are Britain, France, and the United States are in Germany by right. The Germans can't kick them out, right? They can't negotiate a deal with the Soviets providing for the reunification of their country, one of the provisions of which was that the new reunified German state would be neutral, not part of any military bloc. The Western powers were the ones who had the authority to negotiate with the Soviets on all German issues, and not the Germans themselves. These are major constraints on your sovereignty. Not only that, but the Western armies had the right to intervene in extreme circumstances, even in German internal affairs. If there was a threat of a communist or some sort of neo-Nazi takeover of West Germany, the Western armies could intervene. Right? These are major constraints on Germany's independence, on German sovereignty. Okay? Both the military side and the political side. Germany's being brought into the West as an almost equal partner. You know, not fully equal. Not the same rights, either in the military sphere, in the political sphere, as the other Western countries. Right? Why is this a system? Because, in principle, it's a set of arrangements that everyone can live with. First, the Soviets, can they live with this? Yes. Because it solves their number one security problem in Europe, the control of German power. German power is being contained within a structure dominated by the United States. Okay? They don't have to, you know, the NATO system, in principle, it's directed against the USSR, but in reality, it provides a source of reassurance for them. Because German power is limited, Germany is dependent, therefore, on the Western powers for protection, and the Western powers, unlike the Germans themselves, are perfectly happy to live with the status quo of a divided Germany. Therefore, as long as the system can be taken seriously, the Soviets can go along with it. Right. What about the Germans? The Germans, would they accept it? Say, in a sense, it's much harsher than Versailles. And look what happened after Versailles. But things are very different now. And the main thing is that the Germans are now protected against Soviet pressure by the continuation of an American military presence on their territory. Soviets move against West Germany. That means World War III. Soviets won't do it. That's the main thing. But it also symbolizes Germany being taken back into the Western world, a form of moral rehabilitation for the West Germans. Right? Variety of reasons. Yeah, they can accept the system of limits on their power. They have a variety of reasons for accepting it. But the main thing is it provides for their security. It solves their number one security problem. You know, the prevention of Russian attack. All right? Why does it not work? And we know, again, that this third chance for peace doesn't work because just a few years later, the world moves into a new cycle of crises with the Khrushchev ultimatum on Berlin, November of 58, culminating the Cuban Missile Crisis of October of 62. So why does it not work? To answer that, you can't point to the Germans and you can't point to the Russians. The answer is it has to do with the Americans. It's the Americans that don't want to accept. right? We don't want to accept a system based on a permanent, large-scale American military presence in Europe. And we don't want to accept it for all the best reasons, right? This system, the system based on American power, is not consonant with Eisenhower's whole image of America's place in the world. Right? America is not a great imperial power, according to Eisenhower. The Europeans are capable of defending themselves. They should defend themselves. Right? We shouldn't have to carry that burden. Right? And it's that Eisenhower concept, for all the right reasons. Right? It's that Eisenhower concept that plays the fundamental role in making this system not viable. And basically aborting this third great chance for peace that we see. So to kind of get at this issue, beginning the lecture next time, I want to talk a lot about what the Eisenhower strategy was, and especially the Eisenhower nuclear sharing policy. Okay, don't forget, those of you who need to the exams, they're going to be put in alphabetical order, starting from the A's over there to the Z's over here. Be sure and keep them in order, by the way.
Oh, yeah, sure.
This is conversation. You'll hear it at the end of the tape. Okay.